You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'd just like to welcome everybody here today for our session on the Russian elections. And I'm a little nervous that nobody's sitting at the front. Do you all know something that we don't know? Talking about this subject can make one a little paranoid, so I'm a little confused as to why no one's come. It isn't reserved. There's no assigned seating, so if anybody would like to come down and sit at the front to make us feel less nervous, we'd be thrilled. Also, with faded eyesight, you know, we'll be looking towards the back there to figure out who to engage in questions. I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the Centre on the United States and Europe here at Brookings, under which Russia falls. So Russia is part of Europe as far as Brookings is concerned. And I'm here with my fellow colleagues, Steve Pfeiffer and Cliff Gaddy, all from the Brookings Foreign Policy Studies Programme. Many of you will know Steve and Cliff already. And what we want to do today is have more of a discussion with you, the audience. So this is why I'm making you come to the front. You see, this is none of this is staged and orchestrated. We're going to divide up a number of the sort of bigger questions that obviously have arisen as a result of the recent Russian presidential election among ourselves. I'm going to talk, first of all, just a quick brief overview of some of the takeouts from the election on the domestic political scene. I'm then going to hand over to Cliff, who's going to talk more about the economic business dimensions of things. And then Steve is going to give you a few observations on the foreign policy implications, relations with the United States. Now, the reason we've decided to do it more as a discussion, there's been a lot of events on the elections already in the last few days. I'm sure many of you have been to some of them. There's been a lot happening today. There's some more during this next week. And we thought you might all have Russian election fatigue. So we'd also like to hear from you about some of the questions that you feel might have been unanswered or other things that we might not have thought of that ought to be raised. And there's a lot of people here who we know just as much about these things as we do. And I can see a lot of you out here who look at Russia from various different perspectives. So we'd also like to gauge some of your reactions. So first of all, I'll just throw out a few of the general points that we've taken away from the events. In fact, dating back to September, when President Putin made his famous announcement that the tandem with Dmitry Medvedev, the tandem arrangement of power where he was the prime minister for 4 years and Dmitry Medvedev was the president, was now over. And in fact, that Putin was preparing to come back as president and to run as the sole candidate from the establishment in the election in that just happened this past weekend. Now, this announcement didn't go quite as planned. Putin and probably quite a lot of other people were quite surprised by the rather negative or indifferent reaction that this received on the level of the Russian population. And what we saw in the aftermath of this announcement was that President-to-be Putin's ratings in popular opinion polls were on a downward trajectory. They had actually already been on a downward trajectory. Everything, of course, is relative because they were going from up in the 80 percentiles down into the 60s, but the trend was definitely heading downwards, and it did not pick up when the announcement took place, which is what presumably the people around Putin and Putin himself had anticipated. The other event of note was, of course, the December parliamentary election, which has had a great deal of scrutiny already, and all of us have been discussing that at great length over the last couple of months. The ending, effectively, of United Russia, the ruling party's monopoly on power, and although it retained a majority of seats in the Russian parliament, clearly underscored that something was wrong in the political system and that the popularity of the system, of the ruling establishment, was not the same as it had been in the past. And although Putin was not directly associated with United Russia, obviously he's not the leader, was not the leader technically of the party, but it was the party that was giving him support, there was a lot of concern on the part of Putin's campaign team after this that the negative reaction to United Russia in the parliamentary elections had had an impact on Putin's own political standing. Now, what have we seen as a result of the March 4th election? Well, clearly Putin remains still the most popular individual political figure in Russia. And I think we can say that irrespective of what the actual vote tally was. Was it 50%? Was it 64%? I think in many respects the percentage doesn't really matter, though of course it matters from the point of electoral politics, and you know we can talk about that as much as anybody wants to. But Putin is still the most popular individual political figure in the Russian political space. Now, that being said, there wasn't exactly a great deal of competition in the field, particularly for the presidential race. There were only five people in the race, and four of them, Of the four, three have already established a really long track record of losing presidential political campaigns before. And they're also not exactly new faces. So Mr. Zyuganov got his usual sort of percentage, in fact, in presidential races. He actually did probably better in 1996 when he ran for the presidency, but it was, you know, pretty close. Mr. Zhirinovsky, you know, pretty much his sort of standard percentage. Mr. Moronov has run before as well. He probably got a little less than he thought. And then there was a new person in the race, Mr. Prokhorov, who perhaps did a little bit better than anticipated. But the main point is that he was not potentially a serious contender in the race. Now, a lot of the questions have been, would this have been different had there been more of the opposition politicians in the race? If Grigory Yavlinsky had been allowed to run, for example, if someone like Vladimir Ryshkov or Boris Nemtsov or any of the other people who have been out there in the opposition, Mr. Lomonov, Garry Kasparov, well, probably this would have just spread the field even further. It would have looked much more like the Republican candidate field that Mr. Romney is going up against right now. There would have been a whole assortment of different people. So one would have expected Mr. Putin's percentage to come down, but he would still, presumably, again, I mean, I think that's a fair assertion, have emerged as the still the most singular popular candidate, although there might have been then a question of a second round in the race. So what's the deal here? Now, what we've seen, however, is that a real opposition has emerged at the grassroots to Putin. So it's not the point, really, of the candidates and who is out there where we've seen real political change. What we have seen is that now, something that was not evident before, is that there's a lot of opposition to Mr. Putin in the Russian political space. But it's at the grassroots level, and it's not necessarily manifested in an individual candidate. This might be something that we might see develop, but this is something that the December parliamentary election really underscored. And the country is split politically, with a good 50% of the population seeming to want something else, something that's not Mr. Putin, although they don't quite know exactly what yet. And there just isn't another candidate out there yet that is going to give Mr. Putin a run. So I think what we can conclude from the presidential election is that Mr. Putin's political brand is in decline. We saw that in September, we've seen that through December, and although he's managed to boost his ratings again, I think that is the general trend. People are still voting for him, but he's become tired as a politician. And that's actually a pretty common thing. You might have heard me say this in other settings before. Mr. Putin has now found himself in the dilemma of every other normal politician out there. People get sick of seeing you after a period of time. You can be Tony Blair, you can be Charles de Gaulle, you can be Winston Churchill, you can be Margaret Thatcher. You might get Meryl Streep to play you in a movie later on, but eventually in your own political setting, a Meryl Streep could play Mr. Putin. Glenn Close has played a man recently, so I think maybe that's the next thing for Meryl Streep. We'll see if she can get an Oscar for that one. But in any case, joking aside, Mr. Putin's brand has gone the way of other pretty charismatic, important politicians in their political space. He's not going to be the same politician that he was before. He also ran the election on the past. He wasn't really running it on the future, and that's another notable point. And there's a lot of people here who've been following Russia very closely for several decades, and he was running his political campaign as if this was the 1990s. And in fact, that was all of his reference points. He's running with a lot of political candidates also from the 1990s, with the exception of Mr. Prokhorov. So it's hardly really surprising, based on a platform of the past and continuity, that again, he would win in this election. There was no real argument here about the future. It was really saying, we're going to continue the trajectory that we've been on for the last 20 years. You've all done fairly well by it, so let's continue this. Now, the results of the election now being out, we've seen protests on the street. Things are going to continue. There's supposed to be another protest in the next week or so. We have the inauguration coming up. Maybe perhaps some of you, I haven't been able to determine yet, or maybe I just missed this today, when the inauguration is supposed to be. The guess would be May 7th, which would be when Medvedev's term expires, although he could actually theoretically have it before then. But Putin may now calculate that the opposition numbers are dwindling. There's not so many people out there in the street. There's, again, with no clear opposition figure to coalesce, it's quite might be easy now to appropriate the agenda of the opposition. The people on the streets have made it quite explicit they don't want to overthrow the system. They're not seeking violent upheaval. They want institutional change. They want some space for new politicians to emerge. So it looks like this now might not be an easy quest now to divide and conquer the opposition as we've done in the past. But what I think, you know, me and my colleagues here are trying to show, and Cliff is going to pick up on this theme, this is not the past. This isn't the Russia of the 1990s. It's not even the Russia of the 2000s. And what we've seen over the last several months is that Russia really has changed, that politics in Russia is now different. The population is more diverse. And when you look at some of the preliminary results across the country, you see some really interesting indications of this. And I don't know if some of you have seen this. This is the new world we're in. This is a Twitter pic. I'm very proud of this, actually, because being in my 40s, you know, I'm not of the new internet generation that we've seen out on the streets in Russia. So it's not always, you know, if Mr. Putin's having a hard time keeping up with it, I'm having a hard time as well, and I don't know how Steve and Cliff are doing this. But this is a really great spread here from, you know, one of the many people are observing this about really how the results for Mr. Putin's election were spread out across the country. And you can see right down here at the bottom, this is very tiny, also hard for the those of us who are eyesight challenged as age has come on. This is Moscow, and up here we have Chechnya. So Mr. Putin's base of support is very interesting. His highest base of support is in the North Caucasus in Chechnya, not a place that is renowned for being closely linked to Mr. Putin, apart from in a rather negative sense from the 1990s. But it's the region that's most heavily dependent on subsidies from the centre and on its leadership having a close, tight relationship to the Kremlin. And the other high bases of support are similar regions in the North Caucasus and elsewhere in Russia that are heavily dependent on subsidies from the centre. And his lowest base of support is Moscow, the capital city, where it seems to be well below 50% based on all of the polling. And this is where the new urban middle class has emerged over the last decade. Now, this is also a group that's really prospered under Mr. Putin. But what seems to have happened is they've prospered under Putin, but they've become politicised as a result of the events over the last several months. And now they are actually actively engaged in political campaigns against him. So the big question that we're looking forward to now over the next several months is how the political system moves forward past the presidential election, where Putin is master of the Kremlin, master perhaps of the rest of Russia, but is not the master of Moscow. And I think this opens up an awful lot of questions that hopefully we'll discuss over the course of the next hour or so. And Cliff, I'll hand over to you here because I know you're going to pick up on some of these issues.
I am, thank you. In fact, I would like to talk a few minutes about the relationship between the economics and this new urban middle class. First, however, I would like to just say a word about the views of the international business community, the investor community towards Russia and Putin's re-election. Because what it gives us is a headline that the good news for this group of people is business as usual. That's the optimistic conclusion of a number of investment analysts as they look at now the period of unpredictability, of uncertainty about the outcome of the election and the protest is allegedly passed. And we can return to the kind of Russia and the kind of Russian economic development that we had seen in the past. There's good reason why, as an investor, one would want to see business as usual, business as it has been in Russia over the past decade. You merely have to look at an international comparison of the performance of national stock markets across the world. I often do this kind of exercise that maybe is more effective if I had my slides and charts, but let me describe it to you. Suppose on the day that Putin took over as president of Russia, January the 1st, 2000, you had $100 and you had several hundred dollars. You invested $100 bills in the national stock markets, in an index of various national stock markets, and just you kept one $100 bill under your mattress and you put another in an inflation-proof U.S. bond. What would be the results? Well, now, today, last week is when I have the results, your inflation-proof bond would be worth $134. In other words, that you would have to have that much money in today's money to have the equivalent purchasing power of that $100 bill in 2000. So $134. If you had invested in the stock markets of the United States, United Kingdom, Japan, Germany, most other European and developed stock markets, none of them would have outperformed that inflation-proof bond. None of them would be over $134. The U.S. would be down around 93. So to make money, you would have had to invest it in the emerging markets. It's not a secret. Everybody knows they performed better. So you would have gone to the BRICS. If you had invested in China, you would have $200. If you had invested in India, you would have roughly $300. If you had invested in Brazil, you would have about $400. If you had invested in Russia, you would have over $1,000. And that you have to keep that in mind when you think about the way people whose money is what they're really concerned about have looked at Russia over this past decade. Now, there are very few, if any, who believe that you'll find those same kinds of returns from an investment in Russia as you did over the past 10 years. But that having been said, Russia still represents an area of real promise, or at least of hope, for investors, and including foreign direct investors. Now, they basically have come to Russia or continue to come to Russia for two reasons, both pretty much directly connected to Russia's source of wealth, its oil. If you could invest in oil companies, you would do that, of course. To the extent that you can't, you indirectly invest in oil by investing in something you can sell to people who make their money or get their money from oil, who are on a buying spree with oil money. And that, I think, characterizes the Russian population in general, Russian consumers, and not least the Russian government, truly on a buying spree with oil money. And it is an area of promise for a lot of big United States international corporations. The U.S.-based corporations, of course, are very, very concerned about granting permanent normal trade relations status to Russia so that they can continue to take part in this buying spree on the part of the Russian government. That, of course, this business as usual, that was my point, and that, of course, is what Putin wants. That is really all that Putin wants. He wants to continue, as Fiona said, on this trajectory of the past 10 years, and he's convinced that he can, and he has experts and groups who have drawn up plans of why that can happen. He's ready to get back to it. He's terribly annoyed by these political protests that have gotten in the way of his plans. I don't think he's in any mood whatsoever to make concessions to the new middle class, this new urban middle class, to the protesters. Even if he were, I just don't think he's capable of doing it. I don't think he has a clue of how they think and what they want. But I am pretty convinced that they are likely to continue to annoy him greatly as they pursue their aims and therefore interfere with his program. Now, on this question of the new urban middle class, or at least a slice of a middle class that seems to characterize the people who are most dissatisfied with what's been happening in Russia, what I'd just like briefly to do is show the connection of their status, their existence, and perhaps their future with the economic situation that faces Russia. Overall, the Russian economy, and that is the reason why business as usual is good news for the investor class. The economy is frankly fairly robust. No economy in today's world is immune to shocks that are likely to come. But if you think about it, Russia still has the third largest foreign exchange reserves in the world after China and Japan. It has one of the lowest, if not the lowest, debt to GDP ratio, the thing we're so concerned about with the failing European states, Greece, and so forth. It has a very, very low debt-to-GDP ratio. Its budget is on the verge of being balanced. It has some money still in its reserve funds that can cover a budget deficit. Not great, but better off than many, many other countries. But there is a real fragility behind all of that, below all of that, and that fragility, I think, may be most acute, most serious for this new middle class. The new middle class, like it or not, despite all the people's comments about Russia being overly dependent on oil and gas and the need to diversify, etc., the corruption it engenders and so forth, it's simply a fact that it was oil and gas revenues that created, if you like, the new middle class. They created the preconditions for the existence of this new middle class. They are very dependent on that flow, and conversely, a shock to the oil and gas flow of oil and gas revenues into Russia can affect them very, very greatly. Now, it's well known that Russia, as a nation, restored its place in the world, its independence, its sovereignty, its dignity, thanks to the oil and gas revenues. This was a priority that Putin had of paying down the debt, building up the foreign exchange reserves. Russia, as a nation, regained some dignity. But Russia's as individuals, and in particular this group of people that we characterize as the new middle class, I think also owe a new position of dignity and independence to the oil and gas boom. Russians as individuals really became Europeans over these past 10 years thanks to that revenue. However, right now, real incomes, generally in Russia, and I think for this group as well, are nearly stagnant. After a decade of very, very rapid growth, 2011 was the lowest growth of real incomes in Russia of all the post-crisis years, of all the years of the Putin tenure. It was barely above zero. The new middle class is not prepared to cut back, scale back, obviously, and live under austerity. They continue to spend, though they're not earning as much, or at least the income growth, the earnings growth, is not continuing at the same pace. The spending pace, personal spending, household spending, consumer spending, is growing almost as fast as before. The explanation is they draw down on their savings, and they are borrowing. They are borrowing in order to continue this consumption pattern. But look at their situation. They are earning money in a lower middle income country at best. Average per capita income in dollars at the market exchange rate. And by the way, that's the way to do it. The purchasing power parity sort of stuff. That may be working for ordinary Russians out there in the provinces. If you want to look at the situation for this new urban middle class, don't do that. Just take their incomes and translate it at the market exchange rate into dollars and euros. They are living in a world of dollars and euros, even if the prices may be denominated in rubles. I'll get to that in a second. And that's the way to understand it. But the per capita income of the average Russian across the country is about $8,000. Now, in Moscow, it's $18,000 annual income. It's a different country. Moscow is a different country than the rest of Russia. St. Petersburg is about $10,000. So they're earning money in that world. They're spending money in a Western European economy, more expensive, by the way, than the U.S. And I want to conclude just by giving, there's something that I play around with occasionally that I find very valuable. You're all familiar, I guess, at least by hearsay, with this economist Big Mac Index, because it's a product that's sold everywhere in all countries, and you can use that as an index of purchasing power parity by looking at the relationship between the cost of a Big Mac in any country given compared to the normal income. Well, I have a different index that I think is more appropriate for this new urban middle class in Russia. It's called the IKEA index. And it's very handy. This talk about a global world. If you go to IKEA, www.ikea.com, the good thing about IKEA is they have all their catalogs online there, and you just click on the country you want. And since IKEA has identical products in every country in the world, with those stupid Swedish names, they're exactly the same thing. You just compare the prices. So what I did, and what I've done this for quite a while, is select a list of products, you know, representative across all the kinds of stuff they sell, take the ruble price and convert it into dollars at the exchange rate, the market exchange rate. Compare that then with the American catalog, right? What we pay when we go out there to College Park or wherever we go to, whichever IKEA we go to. And what you find, and this has pretty much been true for quite a while, is that the Russian pays 50% more for the exact same product as you would pay. 50% more. If it cost $100 for us, it cost $150 for the Russian. My point is that, and that I take that index as important because I think it symbolizes a whole range of the kind of cost, the whole range of expenditure items that this new urban middle class, those who have enough money to purchase these kinds of things, or who have enough money to travel abroad, to go on vacations to Spain or Turkey or wherever it is they're going, they are spending money as Western Europeans would spend money. They are earning money in a Russian economy that in general has a lower level of income and which is extremely dependent upon these oil and gas revenues, the revenues, in fact, from oil and gas exports that continue to flow into the country. The squeeze is already on. It's been on for about 4 years. Incomes have been more or less stagnant for 4 years. And it is very likely that the situation might get tighter. And I want to point that out because I think that this really is something to keep in mind as you look forward to the future. The wealth that this group has enjoyed has, in a way, been discounted for the, that's something in the past. And what now it matters is expectations about the future. And I find no strong hope or prospects that there will be the kind of income increases, real income increases to this group of Russians that could content them in an economic sense. Political expectations, other expectations have been raised. There is no countervailing prospect of a countervailing increase in their economic status. I think it's a formula for a continued and intensified dissatisfaction and discontent that I would frankly label as the main factor affecting Russia's economic future. We can talk a little bit more about that later and maybe talk about any ideas of what Putin's program really embodies, but I wanted to underscore the economic underpinnings and factors involved with what Fiona talked about.
And Truth in Advertising, Cliff's married to a Swede, so when he says, silly Swedish names, it's not a slur against the Swedes for all of our Swedish embassy friends who are here. Just getting nervous. Anyway, here we are, Steve.
Now, thanks, Fiona. Let me talk a little bit about some implications for Russia's foreign policy and specifically for U.S.-Russia relations. And I'm not going to be able to match Cliff with the Big Mac or the IKEA index. And I don't think I'm going to be able to come up with something quite as pithy as what Fiona had, which was Vladimir Putin, the Mitt Romney of Russian politics. But let me talk about a few. There was an inference there. But let me offer just three considerations on what Putin's return means for Russian foreign policy. First of all, although he was the nominal number two as prime minister the last 4 years, he never really left on big questions. So it really is inconceivable that there would have been a reset in U.S.-Russia relations or a New START treaty or Russian support in 2010 for a U.N. Security Council resolution that imposed an arms embargo on Iran if Vladimir Putin had disagreed with those actions. So his return, I suspect, is going to see a certain amount of consistency, continuity in Russia's strategic course. There's no reason, I would say, to think that on May 7 you see Russian strategic approach to foreign policy veering off in a new direction. The second point is that while there may be a lot of continuity in the substance, the style and the tone of Russian foreign policy will change. It's not going to be the warm, fuzzy Dmitry Medvedev that I think leaders here in the White House and Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy have become used to dealing with. And there's a particular factor here for the United States, which is that Mr. Putin has a wariness, a skepticism about U.S. policy goals, about U.S. policies in general. And part of that goes back to his background as an officer in the KGB in his formative years when the United States was the glavny protivnik, the main opponent. Part of it also goes back to his experience dealing with the Bush administration from 2000 to 2008, where in Mr. Putin's narrative, and I think there is some basis for this, he extended himself in 2001 in the aftermath of 9/11, supporting military action against the Taliban, not hindering the deployment of American troops into Central Asia to support those operations, and reacting quite calmly to the Bush administration's decision to withdraw from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. But he then feels later on, between 2005 and 2008, he did not see any real effort by Washington to address what he considers Russia's main concerns: strategic arms limitation, missile defense in Europe, enlargement of NATO, or graduating Russia from Jackson-Vanik. The reset took place after Dmitry Medvedev had become president. Also with Mr. Putin, I think if you go back and look at the way he talks, there is sort of a conspiratorial view that he looks at, a prism through which he views the outside world. So, for example, if you look at the way he speaks about the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, what happened in Tunisia and Egypt last year, these are not events, they're not manifestations of local discontent with a stolen election or poor governance, but they seem to be part of a wider American plot, inspired, directed, funded by the United States, and somehow aimed at Russia. And that seems a bit paranoid, but when you read the way he talks about these, he says it so often, I think you have to come to the conclusion that he actually does attach some credibility to that. The third set of considerations I would offer on Mr. Putin and foreign policy would be he will be coming back to the presidency in a fairly difficult domestic context in two ways. First of all, as Fiona's described, he's not going to be engaging with the outside world with confidence that he has a solid base of domestic support at home. There is a group of opposition, people that are unhappy with his leadership, and that will be one factor weighing on him. Second, I think Cliff touched on some of the economic fragilities there. There are some difficult economic questions he's going to face. The Russian economy does need modernization. And Mr. Putin, over the course of the last 4 months, has made some fairly expensive campaign promises, increasing pensions, raising wages for doctors and teachers and others. He's announced with some fanfare a fairly ambitious arms modernization program. So it'll be a test to see whether the Russian economy can support all of that. And he may find that he has to make some difficult guns versus butter decisions. Now, how does this figure into how he plays his foreign policy? Well, one option might be to sort of build and choose the United States as the logical candidate, the enemy image, to sort of rally people around him. And that's a possibility. Certainly there is that history in Moscow. But an alternative might be is to, in fact, to seek a calmer foreign policy so that you could, in fact, turn your attention and focus more on the domestic challenges. And we just don't know at this point. A couple of comments on specifically U.S.-Russia relations, and I proceed from the premise that the reset has led to a significant improvement in U.S.-Russia relations, and I offer as the point of comparison August-September of 2008 when they hit their low point since 1991. And if you go back to 2008 and the aftermath or during the crisis and the conflict between Russia and Georgia, the U.S.-Russia relationship at that point was so thin that there is no evidence that concern about damage to that relationship had any impact in terms of restraining Russian behavior towards Georgia. I think that's changed now. I'm not sure in a hypothetical crisis between Russia and Georgia, you know, the U.S.-Russia relationship would stop that, but there would certainly be a different debate in Moscow today because the Russians do have equities in that relationship. It's also true, though, that the low-hanging fruit has been plucked. And now Washington and Moscow face some tougher questions than they had to face in 2009 and 2010. But as you look at those issues, you know, it's not clear to me that there's an obvious reason why Vladimir Putin would want to turn the clock back to 2008 or turn the relationship upside down. Let me comment just on a few questions. You know, arms control has been one of the success stories of the relationship. It's now fairly tightly wound up into a ball and linked fairly heavily to missile defense. And this is one where Mr. Putin during the campaign was fairly strong in terms of saying missile defense is going to be an obstacle to what we want to do. And we'll have to see how he plays that now, because if Russia holds to its current position, it runs the risk of looking impotent as NATO goes ahead with its own plans without taking into account Russian concerns. And likewise, if Russia, I think right now Russia appears to be unready for further talks on reducing nuclear weapons. But there are a couple of questions out there. First of all, if you look at the New START treaty, there are certain advantages that the United States has under that treaty. For example, numbers of non-deployed strategic warheads. Now, that's something I think serious Russians worry about. And if the ambitious arms modernization plan that was outlined in the article 2 weeks ago can't be met because of the other demands on the government budget, does that make the Russians more inclined to say less, would like to get back into some kind of an arms control exploration? So there may be, and I say may, I'm not certain, but there may be incentives for the Russians to engage in a more productive way on arms control, probably though not until 2013, because I think they want to see who wins our election in November 1st. Second, economic relations between the United States and Russia. I thought it was interesting in an otherwise fairly hard-nosed article on foreign relations, Putin, when he talked about the economic component, you know, investment, trade, commercial relations between the United States and Russia, said they really aren't what they should be. It should be more, which is the same view here. You know, how do you develop those relations in a way that gives some ballast to the relationship in the same way that the economic interaction between the United States and China cushions the relationship a bit against political problems? And it'll be interesting to see how that develops. You know, my own sense is that's probably not going to be changed so much as a result of U.S.-Russian interaction. It will really turn on what the Russians and what Mr. Putin do in terms of reforming the business and investment climate within Russia, creating things like rule of law, contract enforcement, reducing corruption and such. A third set of questions that will be on the agenda is how do the United States and Russia manage some differences? One is Iran. And I would first start by saying, in fact, the Russians have come a long way on Iran. When I was still in the U.S. government back in the first Bush administration, the idea that Russia would at some point vote to support a total arms embargo on Iran, just no one would have thought that that was realistic. The Russians went that far. But I think we're perhaps getting to the point where U.S. and Russian positions may diverge. And that's due to a couple of reasons, one of which is the sense of urgency. In Washington, the idea of a nuclear-armed Iran is a nightmare scenario. And just look at all the talk you've seen in the last 2 weeks about possible military action. For the Russians, a nuclear-armed Iran is a bad thing. They don't want to see it. But they've had a relationship with Tehran since 1979 that the United States has not had. And they figure that diplomatically they can manage that problem. So there's a different sense of urgency there. And they also have some interest at stake that they don't want to sacrifice. Syria is a question now, and probably one of the hot issues on the U.S.-Russia agenda. And there are a number of reasons that are behind, I think, the Russian position. One is they look at the Middle East. They don't have many allies there. Mr. Assad is one. They're reluctant to throw him over. Second, and I think this is a more legitimate reason, is they're just not sure if Assad goes down, what comes in afterwards. And I think there are actually a number of people in the West who are asking that question. A third rationale is there's a little bit of payback in opposing the United States and Britain and France and the UN Security Council, because there's a view in Moscow that when the Russians did not block the UN Security Council resolution on Libya, the West really took that resolution and stretched it in every possible way. So there, I think that's going to be a difference match. And then finally, the other sets of, last set of differences I think that have to be watched are going to be differences regarding the post-Soviet space, where Mr. Putin does not want to recreate the Soviet Union, but he certainly wants to have a sphere of influence, and that means deference from neighboring states. Things like you don't join NATO, you do not join the European Union if Moscow objects. And the U.S. takes a very different view with regard to these countries, that they are independent actors, and that sets up some natural frictions there. So I'll just close with maybe two or three questions that may govern how the relationship goes in the next 6 to 12 months. First one will turn on, are the sides able to move beyond election rhetoric? And the Russians have to start moving now. I suspect that over the next 5 or 6 months, you're going to see some rhetoric here in Washington in the context of our election, which we may have to move away from, too. Second question, how do the domestic challenges affect and constrain the foreign policy, especially in Russia, but also perhaps here in 2013? And then finally, are the United States and Russia, are Washington and Moscow, going to be able to manage differences, particularly those differences that arise as a result of a surprise, when they're not prepared, when they get caught off guard? So, you know, stop at that point.
Thanks, Steve. And miraculously, we're actually not much over our allotted time here, which is a miracle for people sitting on podiums where you tend to kind of take control and forget to shut up. So we're now going to be able to turn things over to the rest of you. We've got until 4:30. And there are many people here who, as I've pointed out before, some of them are escaping at the back already. I guess maybe we said something that they've, or they've gone to get coffee, who knows. But there's a lot of people here.
Oh, right, yeah, they're Swedes.
Our Swedish colleagues are still here. They're going out to check their IKEA prices. But there's a lot of people here who've been watching this very closely. So we'd also encourage you to share your observations with us. Please introduce yourselves for the benefit of everyone else who is here and doesn't know you. And we're not trying to avoid questions, but we really would like to hear back from other people about some of the things that they have observed from the election and the events leading up to it. If nobody puts their hand up, well, thank you, Daniel. This is our colleague from SAIS, who's from Italy, but if you could introduce yourself for everyone as well, please, Daniel.
Daniele Moro, Johns Hopkins Center, Transatlantic Relations. One is a clarification from the professor about the IKEA prices. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that they are 50% more expensive in Russia? And the second is a question about foreign policy. I follow your reason about the Arab Spring and Iran, but I ask you, how long can a secular state, like a Christian state like Russia, go on with the situation of the Christians in the Islamic countries with this upheaval, because it's not only a problem of strategic, it's also a problem of, in some way, an internal problem of the Christian Russia, if it is, in your opinion. Thanks.
Any other questions that anybody wants to raise right now? So, Cliff, IKEA.
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to waste time on this. It's interesting. I was just interested in using it as an example of the how it looks from the standpoint of the consumer. But it is an interesting question. And in fact, when I accidentally showed this chart to one of my colleagues up in the economic studies, that was the first question she asked was, you know, how do you explain the difference? Well, it's interesting. I've traced those prices, as I said, over time. And the Russian prices, they remain completely stable in ruble terms. And, of course, the exchange rate has remained fairly stable, so they've remained steady. The U.S. prices have changed. They've gotten cheaper. They typically will get cheaper, some of them. But IKEA is a smart business. They know how to set prices. You know, they set them, I guess, on the basis of what consumers are willing to pay, and they have kind of a monopoly position on the market. There are Russian big-box imitators now, but I think IKEA still has a cachet. The U.S. situation environment is much more competitive, as you know, with a different profile, different segment of the market. I'm no expert. I don't know.
So, but it sounds like it's
IKEA.
Like it's
by the way, since IKEA doesn't pay bribes, it's hard to attribute it to, you know, the difference is corruption element. I don't think so.
There was that scandal that IKEA was involved in at one point. But
no, I think they don't pay bribes unless they're very skillful about it, because they make a big deal of the fact that they'll refuse to do it.
So it sounds like it's more an issue related to demand and competition. You're going to be on the spot now. People are going to be asking you for... you're going to have students writing from economics departments all the way and the Swedish colleagues. We have a representative of the Swedish embassy who's going to be running back and probably writing a letter to the head of IKEA saying, hey, how do you explain the fact that in Russia you have higher prices? The other question on the foreign policy, I mean, I'll weigh on this and hand over to Steve. I haven't really seen the Russian government making an issue about the Christian population during the Arab Spring. I mean, obviously, this is one of the reasons why the Russian government has an interest in the Palestinian issue, because there is, of course, the issue of the Russian Orthodox Church and its claims, as a lot of other churches have, on both property and congregational rights in Jerusalem and in the various holy sites. And, of course, Palestinian population, a large portion of that is Christian. But I haven't really seen that, actually, interestingly enough, play out in any major way in the stance that they have adopted on Syria. I mean, maybe somebody else in the audience might have seen this, but it hasn't really been a factor so far.
No, I'd say the same thing. I mean, there does not seem to be any evident pressure on the Russian government from constituencies within Russia on this issue. You know, if it's being done, it's being done very quietly in ways that, you know, aren't visible to those of us who are watching from Washington. I think the interesting observation, though, more on the internal side here, is that the damage I think Russia is doing to its relations with the broader Arab world, where you really do have everyone sort of aligned against, in the Arab world, against Assad, and the Russians are sort of betting on him. And it's interesting because while the Russians sort of focus on this as an issue of dispute with the United States, my own guess is that the U.S.-Russia relationship is broad enough that it can survive that difference on Syria. But when you look at Russian relations with the rest of the Arab world, the Syria issue is going to be a much larger question and potentially could be much more damaging to their longer interests with those countries. They're betting on the wrong horse here.
And that's certainly what we're hearing from our colleagues on the ground in the Middle East. Brookings has a Doha center in Qatar, where a lot of people are looking very closely at Arab political opinion, not just in the Gulf, but more broadly in the Middle East. And they're really seeing a backlash, an angry backlash against Russian policy, and a strong feeling that both Russia and China are on the wrong side of this issue, that it's not an issue of North versus South or East versus West. It's not being looked at in Cold War terms on the ground. There is, of course, a religious aspect to this, of a Sunni versus a non-Sunni leadership issue in Syria, just as we've had the reverse of this in the Gulf. But for the most part, it's being read very differently on the ground in the Gulf and in the Middle East from how it obviously is being in Moscow. There's one domestic dimension for the Russians, however, that isn't, as far as I can see, on the Russian Orthodox side of things. It is that there is a population, a domestic population concern because of the Cherkess, the Circassians, who are a feature of the political and ethnic makeup inside of Syria. This is the North Caucasus populations who were expelled after the various North Caucasian rebellions under the Tsar, and many went off into the Ottoman Empire and now today in Syria and Jordan. There was even, in fact, reports that some of the Cherkess, the Circassian population in Syria, actually has to be returned back to Russia, which is kind of ironic after 150 years of being away. And this actually does have a big domestic component for Russia, because the ancestral lands of the Cherkess, the Circassians, are around Sochi and southern Russia, where the 2014 Olympics are going to happen. There's already been a pan-Cherkess movement that's been stirred up on a political front, and opposition to the Olympics and to the larger development in the area. So this is obviously a bit of a nightmare from Moscow's perspective, that this episodes in Syria might have a knock-on effect in the North Caucasus. But that's really the only larger domestic issue that that we've really seen there. Yeah. Jeff, and then...
Thank you. Jeff Goldstein from the Open Society Foundations. You've spoken a lot today about the middle class. They want change. Putin, he wants stability. But what about another important group, which is the political elite? Do you see any signs in there that they're beginning to conclude that the current economic and political system is not in their long-term interests? Do you think it's possible for Putin, even if he wanted to try and address some of the middle class concerns without losing the elite?
Jeff, who do you think you mean by the political elite? And this is one of these big questions that we always have about this. I mean, are you referring to the oligarchs, the business community at a certain level? Are you talking about the people who are in the inner circle around Putin, the people who are in the power ministries? What do you have in mind when you ask about the political elite? The current version of the Soviet nomenclatura. Well, I mean, this is a tricky question. In fact, we have someone who used to be Andrei Ilyaronov in that group sitting towards the back, who might have fallen into that definition. So, Andrei, maybe. I said in the past. In the past, yeah, you would have been. You were a presidential advisor, so I think that's kind of a. So we'll ask you what you think as well. Because I mean, there are different groups here. I mean, this is what we meant by Russia has become much more diverse. I think it's actually more difficult to even now pin down about who do you mean by these elites. We had a meeting here, a round table, actually just in the last couple of days, where everybody was banding around the term, and they kept talking about the power elite and, you know, different elites. And actually many of these people who fall into what we're calling the urban middle class here would actually have fallen into the old definitions of the Soviet elite. Journalists, professionals, white-collar workers, university students, those were all under the old elite, under the Soviet terms, under the Soviet definition. So they're clearly in a different place entirely. But if you're meaning the people around them, and there are lots of talk about basically individuals in and around the government, we have Alexei Kudrin, clearly somebody who falls under that power elite, seemingly out on the streets talking to the opposition, presenting a different viewpoint, when Medvedev was very much the focal point of the presidency in the tandem, groups around Medvedev pushing for more change. There was one of the arguments in the run-up to the presidential election that if Putin did not basically demonstrate that he had sufficient popularity on the popular basis, was one of the underpinnings of his role as the arbiter among these political elites, that if he was he demonstrated, in fact, that he had a lower percentage point, that this would really undercut his role within the system, and that might lead to more demands about, well, why not have somebody else play this arbiter role? But the main point that maybe Cliff and others, I mean, they'd like to come in on this, have seen that you still have this tight inner circle of people at the very top who are running this system. And one way or another, these guys are all tied together. There seems to be no incentive on their part to change this. And this is why we're seeing really the upsurge in opposition from the grassroots, from these lower levels of people wanting to see this change. I mean, my argument would be that I personally can't see any change unless Mr. Putin decides himself that he is going to change this and the people immediately around him. He's had 4 years in which he was supposedly to hand off to sharing power with Mr. Medvedev. He said this multiple times himself, that Medvedev was an integral part of the tandem. He was the new generation. He was supposed to bring modernization and innovation. He was supposed to be bringing more of a pluralism to the system, more debate, and he was going to be the beginning of bringing more and more people into this system to broaden the space of the elite, to give people more choices, and we haven't seen any evidence of this. Cliff, do you want to pick up on this at all, or Steve, from your points? I mean, I think it's a really very difficult question about, again, and it may sound like we're punting this here, about what do we mean by this elite. And certainly sitting here in Washington, D.C., there are a whole myriad of rumours of oligarchs like Mr. Prokhorov and others who are dissatisfied, who want to see something different, who are dipping their feet into the political waters. And I think we'll hear more and more of this as we move away from the presidential election, given all of the strains in the system that we're talking about here. So I think it's the time that we're going to be paying close attention to how things are going to be shaking out after this. The big question is really whether he changes the composition of the cabinet when he gets into the presidency, and whether there are any really new faces. All we have talked today was Mr. Prokhorov might be found a position in the government. But is that real meaningful change? Does that mark a shift in the power elites? I think that's a question. I don't know. Andre, do you want to say anything on this? If you would have a mind to say it, yeah.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to congratulate Cliff with providing wonderful ammunition for Mr. Putin's propaganda campaign about the Western conspiracy against Russia, because your IKEA index is a perfect weapon for that, because Mr. Putin can say right now that even modest Swedes are able to exploit poor Russians with 50% margin on their products. So what should we expect from all those terrible Brits and especially Americans? So that is why he probably right. But I'd like to bring one more issue in the debate that has not been mentioned, seems to me, neither here nor in any other place before. I mean legality of what has happened right now, not about the legitimacy, but about pure legality. I understand that none of you is a legal expert. Nevertheless, there is some, in strict sense, maybe you are, Fiona, but just, okay, just I would be, in this case, I would especially
be... No, I'm looking at a lawyer sitting in the front here.
...like to hear. Because according to the Russian Constitution, as everybody knows, the Article 81 says very clearly that nobody can occupy the position more than two consecutive terms. And it is interesting that it's not only views have been expressed by politicians or some kind of observers, but also there are two decisions of the, first of all, Constitutional Court of Russia, November 5th, 1998, which clearly says that two terms constitutes an upper limit for anyone to serve as a president. The decision of Supreme Court of year 2001 actually reiterates this position, which says very clearly that it doesn't matter whether it is two consecutive terms or two terms. It's very clear it's the same. It's impossible to be more. In year 2009, commentary, which is official book that is published by Valery Zorkin, the current chair of the Constitutional Court, says very clearly that two terms for president, it's upper limits, no more. So that is why the view of the some kind of specialist in constitutional law in Russia are very clear. That's finished. What is interesting that in three more European countries, we have very similar provisions in Austrian, German, and French constitutions. In all of them, they have the same or very similar provision, that is a two consecutive terms for the president, and that's all. In a discussion with the professors and specialists in constitutional law, from all those countries, they interpreted it very clear. Two terms, that's finished. There is no possibility to be elected for the third term, regardless whether it will be with a break or without a break, it doesn't matter. So my question is, it seems to me it's some kind of, looks like a universal understanding of these constitutional provisions within Russia as well as outside Russia. And we have this such an interesting historical case to analyze. So my question would be to you, why it is not being so well discussed in this some kind of those ranks, and why it's not being discussed by you, why it was discussed everywhere?
Well, I think you just put your finger on it, because there's a lack of constitutional legal experts. Although we have one sitting here. We have Will Partlett, who you might actually have seen some of his commentary on the website, who's actually working with us at Brookings and is actually engaged in a project here on the Russian constitution and is actually parsing Valery Zorkin's every word and utterance since 1990. You can tell he's a busy guy, because Mr. Zorkin, as you've pointed out, has put an awful lot. Now, I actually remember, just on a personal basis, from the 1993 constitution, which may remember the whole debates yourself, there was a big debate in Russia back then as to what was going to be the model of the constitution, and France and the United States were both at least basal models for looking at the issue of the presidency. And I do recall from that time those very debates about whether that was a two-term constitution, that's it, even if you left and then came back into the presidency. But I'm afraid that I'm unable to answer this last question here. And I think that's exactly why you're not seeing so much of a discussion. I'm actually going to ask Will if he has some observations on this. And we'll see actually how much research he's been able to do over the last weeks and what conclusions he's come from. And I think we'll be able to actually put this question to quite a few other people, because I'm actually not sure how many people are looking at this. And I think it's actually a very valid question. And obviously it's one that, if there is some real basis in this, we'll hear what Will has to say, can obviously be used by the opposition and many other people in the elites that Jeff is asking about.
Just one observation, though. I think for me, I'm not sure about for Cliff and Fiona, this is the first time I've heard. I'm not a Russian constitutional expert or legal expert. This is the first time I've heard that point. I have not seen this point coming out of any of the Russians who are demonstrating on this question. So my sense is, if it's not being raised in a significant way within Russia, other countries outside are not going to challenge the question.
If I may add a word, because there was several dozens of attempts to request constitutional courts to comment in this particular situation in Russia, and since all of them have been rejected without any consideration by the current constitutional court, which actually a good indication, because it means that they do understand that those points are valid. So that just those who actually put those requests, they probably right in this current political circumstances. So that is why, even if constitutional judges in Russia right now are extremely shy, in any case, it's an indication that they do not agree with this some kind of the temporal interpretation of the constitution by a few people.
Well,
I think it's interesting that I've not actually heard that either. But that if you looked at Valery Zorkin's written two pretty high profile political articles in the last 2 months, and he hasn't mentioned that. And if it is in his book from 2009, it's interesting that he chose to completely ignore the fact that he actually believes that there should only be a two-turn top to the. But it does seem that he is aligning himself pretty closely with Mr. Putin. Cliff and I have actually found that he and Mr. Putin have watched soccer together, and the relationship between Valery Zorkin and Putin, I think, particularly when it comes to the way that they both view federalism in a unitary state, and reasserting kind of a vertical of power and legal power from the center down, they both agree very clearly that the Russian federal constitution should apply across the entire 14 time zones of Russia. So I do think, from a constitutional view, I think at least with Valery Zorkin comes is in terms, I think they're very close, and I wouldn't think Valery Zorkin would ever publicly at least say that he shouldn't, that it's unconstitutional for Putin to take up a third term.
Well, why don't you comment on Medvedev's call for a constitutional convention that you told me about?
Yeah, and the other interesting legal development is that just on Monday, just after the elections, Medvedev has introduced a bill into the Duma to call a constitutional assembly to revise the constitution. So there does seem to be at least some movement on constitutional political reform. And this is something that Zorkin himself had talked about in one of his articles as, the idea that that any changes that take place in Russia should need to be done legally within the law, that none of this kind of extra legal action, revolution, et cetera, it should all be done through legal channels. And again, whether this is serious or just a blocking tactic is unclear, but I do think that, there's at least some move on the legal front, and it's interesting to see how legal elites in Russia are really are backing this up. Members of the Duma and the members of the federal bar in Moscow are pushing hard on this too. So he does have a, there seems to be a kind of legal elites. If we talk about the different parts of the power elite in Russia, I think legal elites are playing a much bigger role perhaps than they ever have. And they might actually be getting more, they might be getting listened to more by the elite, by people in power in Russia maybe than they have in the past. And whether that will continue, I guess, is an open question.
But it's not necessarily picking on the subject that you're raising here, Andre. But I guess this is another thing for, now you've put all of us on alert, we'll all be brushing up on our Russian constitutionalism and trying to figure out what's happening here. But again, that's one of the problems. We don't have enough people, you know, and certainly here and elsewhere to basically comment on this. And as Steve is saying, if it's not being picked up in a really major way in the Russian political sphere or by the opposition or anything, then it's a bit hard for other people. But, you know, we'll watch this issue now, because you're obviously flagging this, as you usually do, when something is about to come over the horizon. Rich Kazarish, and I'll bring over this lady over here. He's sitting over here at the far end. Yeah, thanks.
Rich Kozlerich from George Mason University. One thing that's been touched on, but I think really needs to be addressed among the category of Putin's commitments before the election, has to do with doing something about corruption. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just wonder what your sense is as to what he's going to be able to do, if in fact it means going after interests that up to this point have supported him, because some of the things that he's talked about, I think, run the risk for him of undermining this very carefully assembled system of economic and political influence. Second is more of an observation. If the domestic political scene has changed radically since the last time he ran for election, I would argue the international energy situation has changed radically. And my question, I guess, would be, given the fact that you've had these shifts in the global gas market, which have undermined Russia's dominant position, perhaps over the longer run in Europe, what about the oil sector, where, Fiona, you can remember the debates we used to have about where has enough investment gone in to the oil side of the Russian energy sector to take advantage of the higher prices?
That lady here had a question. I'm just going to collect a couple more. But Tessa? Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. I'm Katie Fox from the National Democratic Institute. And my question is, why do you think that the protests over Sunday's election were so much smaller than the previous ones? And also, assuming that Russia really has changed and there is a grassroots, more of a grassroots support for reform, how will it be manifested next? Is there going to be an economic shock, or is there a political issue in the near future that you see, and how would you see the Putin responding?
Steve, you want to come, and then I'll walk along the ones you want to pick up on, any of these?
Corruption, but I think this will be more for Cliff. On the corruption point, I guess that is probably, if I look back, and I still think when Mr. Putin became president, was probably the thing I was most surprised about, because Putin, when he came in, talked about corruption, and he seemed to have the background of someone who was going to tackle it in a very serious way. And if you look over the last 11 years, I mean, there has been no effort. I mean, pretty much by anybody's measure, corruption has increased tremendously. And that seems to be part of what these protests are about, is just the unhappiness on the part of the urban middle class with having to deal with corruption day after day after day. And that will be really interesting. I think it's very difficult for Mr. Putin to tackle that in a meaningful way, given the group that around him has benefited from that. You know, unless he comes up with some sort of a magical scheme to say, okay, we're all going legit from now and just draw a line. But that's awfully hard to do, and it's awfully hard to see him doing it.
Any thoughts on the protests and grassroots manifestation? Where next?
Well, I think we watch and see what happens on Saturday to see the size. I mean, there was a certain calculation, which I think was a smart calculation on the part of the government back in December, not to challenge the demonstrations. So let the demonstrations go ahead as long as they took place under the permitted rules. It seemed like the police had clear instructions, be there, but don't engage in anything. And there was perhaps a hope there that these demonstrations would plateau and then drop out. And the government is now going to be watching very closely what happens, because that's being taken as a significant metric for just how deep the dissatisfaction with Mr. Putin is.
Cliff, do you want to come in on these issues, and then I'll cover some of the questions on the energy at the front, and touch on that too?
Yeah. On corruption, I suppose there's so much corruption at so many different levels in Russia that you could conduct a campaign, an anti-corruption campaign, that would serve your purposes. I'm saying put yourself in Putin's shoes, without necessarily undermining, which I agree, that corruption is at the heart of the whole system, without undermining your own system. Putin's whole, with my colleague Barry Ickes, we describe the whole system of political economy in Russia as a rent management system, managing the oil and gas rents. And done so, we traditionally think of, and everybody will talk about, revenues, non-oil gas revenues to the budget and spending of the budget. It's always about what we describe as, that's just the formal side of things. That's the top of the iceberg that sticks above the water that you see. What characterizes Russia, to some extent exists in any resource-abundant economy, but it's really more exaggerated in Russia than anywhere else, simply because the rents are so important for that economy and because of the Soviet legacy. A lot of the rent is distributed informally. And there are a whole range of ways in which it's done. Excess cost, there's also a kind of informal taxes where corporations are expected to put money into public projects without it being tax revenues that they have to pay. They're expected to voluntarily contribute. And the Russians always call it, compulsorily voluntary contributions. And that's a well-known phenomenon. There are certain hidden subsidies and so forth. These are, if you like, hidden rent. And the management system of this is what keeps the whole country together and keeps the various constituencies happy as long as the rents are growing. It's a usual story. You can parcel it out to many different ones without running into problems. When they don't grow, or even worse, when they begin to contract, then you run into real tensions and trade-offs. You have to decide who's going to get what. And I think that's going to be an issue, among other things, for this new middle class. Are they going to get their share? In that sort of a situation in particular, as the manager of the system, you have to be very concerned about the efficiency of your distribution system. Are the goals that you really have set, whatever they are, and we can talk about Putin's goals, but those goals, are they being served? Is this flow of wealth going to the purposes you want it to go to? And along the way, all kinds of dissipation occurs. Rents are leaking out of the system and into the pockets of various people. I think that that's been more or less accepted, again, because the rent flow has been so massive. If you are really concerned in a tight situation about making it more efficient, an anti-corruption campaign fits well into that. It's essentially saying that there are forms of corruption by some people in the system that are not only tolerated, that's the basis of the system. There are other things you shouldn't be doing. You shouldn't be stealing from the intended purposes. It would be like tax evasion. And it is, in effect, tax evasion, just informal taxes that are being evaded. And that's been a problem. Putin's known about it. He's talked about it before. And he could get serious about it. And he wouldn't be sacrificing anybody that he really cares about. And he would be sending a message to everybody else to shape up. So I think, to the extent that he can distinguish between these two, I can easily see him conducting a kind of a brutal anti-corruption campaign without really touching upon the bigger corruption, if you like, that's existing in the top circles.
There's one dimension of this corruption issue that's obviously, as you're alluding to, is playing into the protests. And this is the phenomenon of raiding of corporate entities below the tops of, that's what Jeff was referring to, these sort of power elites where the political and economic power is fused, the kind of untouchables in the system, only touchable by people within the inner circle. And you're really seeing in the protest movements, as you know, we've heard in discussions with people about the successful business people who have been the entrepreneurs who have built up something from scratch and then have been predated upon by others within the system who see that they've had a successful operation and want to take it over. And then they actually use some of the anti-corruption campaigns. I mean, it's the classic as what's happened with Sergei Magnitsky, Bill Browder and Heritage, you know, that's got most of the attention here. But there are so many other stories about this that don't involve Western international companies and US and British and other investors, but that involve Russian businessmen who have set something up and then have had their company taken away from them and found themselves in jail accused of fraud and corruption. And it's a lot of the people associated with them who are now protesting on the streets and asking for something different. This is where you're getting a lot of the backlash within the system. But as Cliff has said, this is all built in to the system. And to really tackle that, that's going to be very tough because a lot of these people are the base of the support of this system because it allows them, in fact, to carry out these raids on other people's business property. But this is another example of why people are so angry. You have the petty corruption at the level of bribe-taking among the police, even the police backlash against this. You have the corruption of privileges. The whole system is built on privileges and access. I mean, if you have something, the Kremlin Property Agency, that doles out access to dachas and hospitals and cars and planes and gives people permission to drive around with a blue light on top of their car. Remember, many of you will have seen the Blue Bucket Brigade. We talked to someone who had joined dispute with a bicycle rider, an incredibly fearless person to ride a bicycle around Moscow, who put a blue bottle cap on top of their helmet, so they became the Blue Bottle Cap Brigade to join the protest and got all kinds of praise for doing this. I mean, the system is rotten, frankly, to the core on so many different aspects. So once you start to really tackle it, you have to basically dismantle the whole thing, which seems somewhat unlikely, but it is a definite part of the protest. And I think, you know, getting to your question, Katie, this is going to be really where we see how much legs these protests have, because a lot of the protests are against this kind of institutional distortion. I mean, the lack of the kind of questions of legality that Andrew was talking about, the constitution level, but really going all the way down where rules are not just not enforced, but they're used and applied against people who are otherwise law-abiding citizens and who deeply resent the use of and abuse of the law rather than the rule of the law. It's all of these instances of corruption where people just find their lives upended as a result of these difficulties of just simply getting ahead. And this seems to be what the bulk of the protesters are really demanding, which is a change. And it's not just the new generation of protesters, but it's also the people who have been supporting the Communist Party, who have also been demanding more of a predictability and more of the actual enforcement of the real rules that are actually on the statute books. And actually many of the Russian nationalists as well, who are asking for the same kinds of issues. So as the system continues to rot, I really think you'll see more of this. And it really will be these trigger points where people feel that the rules have not been enforced and where there's been arbitrary application or there's been deliberate distortions, because that's what really we saw in the election in December. People were angry about the fact that the system didn't play to its own rules, the rules that they actually said that they were upholding. And even Mr. Zyuganov has actually come out with really, quite, for him, quite strong statements in the wake of the presidential election on these topics. It really depends on how much people get activated by this. John, I think you've had a two-finger on this point.
Yes.
If we can get the mic over.
John Evans, I'm a Putin observer from St. Petersburg days. I just wanted to alert people to a very interesting article that came across around 11 o'clock this morning on the second version of Johnson's List by John Helmer, who's a longtime observer of the business environment and in Moscow. And he points out that something that people have missed, between Christmas and New Year's, there was an order promulgated by Putin for state organizations to report on their dealings with certain of the oligarchs. And it looks like an attempt to do an end run on Mr. Navalny's, some of Mr. Navalny's points about, and the state organizations were, according to Helmer, to report back on their dealings under penalties of certain things happening. So I recommend having a look at this article. I believe it was in the Asia Times, but it was in the second Johnson's List from this morning. Thank you.
Cliff?
I just want to say, yeah, the order is that all of the companies involved have to report the interest of the corporate officers of these corporations, their spouses, their siblings, and their children with companies, affiliated companies, companies that have any sort of business relationship with the main company. And so the idea is to find out how, you know, if these sweetheart, allegedly, to find out the pattern of these sweetheart deals and so forth. Number one, like a lot of information collecting, a lot of collecting of information about business practices, financial information, and so forth goes on in Russia. Question is, once it's collected, what happens to it? Putin got his start in Ankudrin in Moscow in 1996 with doing exactly that sort of a thing. That was the source of their power, really. So, second thing is that it's very interesting to note that one of the companies, you would expect that there would be some obvious candidates to be on a list of state-connected companies. Rosneft is not among them. And Putin apparently claims that he asked Mr. Sechin, who is in charge of this list, if Rosneft should be on it, and he said, no.
Your last point, though, about taking up some of Mr. Navalny's points, I mean, this has also been something that we've seen repeatedly over the last several months. I mean, again, getting back to Katie's question about, you know, how do things manifest themselves next? The Kremlin has been very quick to try to pick up on many of the abuses of the system that get people angry and get them on the streets. After the Blue Bucket Brigade took off and all the protests about people with the blue flashing lights, you know, basically killing people as they were driving at great speed down the Moscow thoroughways, they actually did a similar thing. They asked for an order of all the people who had the blue lights and did people have an accurate, proper license for them. And then there was a lot of public display of people being chastised and punished for misappropriating a blue light and not having the proper license for it, because it had actually got people really angry. And for a long time, it looked like that Navalny's blog was being followed very closely by the Kremlin and trying to pick up on some of the issues that were getting him excised and getting other people excised. So, I mean, this is something that, you know, one would anticipate. If Putin is trying to pick off the agendas of the protesters, trying to make the protest dwindle by really sort of seeming to pick up on these things that are getting people the most angry. We saw a very similar phenomenon after the huge protest, the last set of huge protests, which was against the monetization of benefits. And if you call that, I mean, there was vast numbers of elderly ladies, you know, everybody's grandmother and, you know, aunts and everybody out on the streets protesting that. And the government was very quick to try to respond to that, to defuse this. So as much as they can, they will seem to appropriate those agendas. I think our question would be, is that sufficient? Because that's what they've been doing all along. Putin has been presenting himself as the man for all seasons, the man for all candidates. He's the Social Democrat. He's the Communist Party. He's the Nationalist. He's the Liberal Democrat. He's the this, he's the that. And what the protests are about, though, is they don't really believe this. And even if he does appropriate the agendas, are they still pushing out there for the real McCoy, the real candidate that picks up these interests? So I think that really is the test of the system now. I think there was another... Jeff, do you have a related question?
No, not really.
Go ahead, though.
Okay. If I could, I'd actually like to shift back a little bit to foreign policy. Steve, I think you were quite right in mentioning Iran as being one of the real potential obstacles to the maintenance of a close U.S.-Russia relationship over the coming months. And I'd like to maybe throw another variable in here, which is, you know, we had Mr. Netanyahu in Washington a couple of days ago, and there was a lot of talk, both in his meetings with the president and then publicly, about the possibility of military action against Iran, whether by Israel or by the United States. I know Putin has said, you know, the consequences of that would be catastrophic, that it's something that should be avoided at all cost. Nevertheless, it looks like we're getting closer and closer to a situation where that's at least a realistic possibility. So my question then is, what would the consequences be for Russia of military action involving Iran, and specifically on relations with the United States? And then what can be done before there's a real crisis involving Iran to sort of ameliorate some of those consequences?
I think one consequence may well be is, you know, if one of the after effects of that conflict is, if not a closing, but at least making transit through the Strait of Hormuz more difficult for oil, is the price of oil may go up. So there may well be people in Moscow who say this is actually a good thing because the price of energy goes up. You know, that means more money.
Yeah, that gets to Rich's question. We've forgotten to answer. Yeah. So we'll.
But I think though, in political terms, in geopolitical terms, again, Russia's looking at unattractive options here. I mean, they don't want to see Iran with nuclear weapons, but also the military conflict, I don't think, advances their geopolitical interests for a couple reasons. One is Iran is the one country in the Persian Gulf that they have a decent relationship with. Military conflict is going to have a negative impact on that. But second, it's hard for me to see what Russia does. And I suspect that in the event of a conflict, you know, Russia will say some things, and there'll be loud protests in the UN Security Council. But in real terms, Russia is going to end up sitting on its hands. And that is, I think, unattractive to many in Moscow because it shows that Russia really, you know, is not at the level where it sort of can impact every major crisis, that it really is ignored. It's somewhat impotent in that kind of crisis. But there's no real option for them to engage in this. So the Russians, I believe, don't look at a crisis, a military conflict, as something that is going to be good. Plus, they also just say, you know, once that conflict begins, and even though there may be an intention either on the part of Israel or the United States to try to limit it, you know, once you start dropping bombs, it spins off in different directions, and who can say where it's going to go? So their commentary on this, I think, reflects a genuine unease about the prospect.
They could also, depending on how this evolves further in the wake of the visit here and our and the Europeans' determination for another round of sanctions, have to recalculate the positions that they've undertaken so far, as Steve is alluding here. I mean, I think Russia's been actually pretty consistent in many respects with policy Iran. Its most preferred outcome is just to keep things as they are. They really do not want to have anything precipitous. And when they have joined with the US and the Europe in terms of a harder line, I mean, it's really because of this great fear of Israel basically doing something. And the last time around, it just seemed to be that, in fact, I mean, Netanyahu made his own visit to Moscow behind the scenes. It wasn't so behind the scenes because people found out about it. But in any case, the Russians actually talked about it. But they were clearly impressed at the time that this was very serious. Over the last several weeks, they've been vacillating, wondering whether all this talk means this is just a bluff. I mean, Moscow is really trying to game the situation here and figuring out whether they have to try to take any action, precisely because they fear all of the consequences that that Steve has outlined. They're also looking to how does everybody else react in the region? How do the Saudis react? What's the German and the other European position? So I think for Russia, this is a real dilemma here. They obviously do not want this scenario. They have great and, I think, justifiable concerns about it. And the impact on the energy issues getting to Rich only has a very short-term benefit. I mean, as Cliff has, I think, made abundantly clear, the more that there's an upward pressure on oil and gas, yes, that's beneficial for the Russian state budget, but it isn't beneficial overall for the Russian economy because of all the knock-on effects globally. And Russia still hasn't been able to entirely capitalize on this increase in oil prices when it comes to its own gas sales. I mean, they're still trying to wrestle the Chinese to the mat about a gas price. They haven't been able to pivot to sell oil and gas so easily to Asia as they had anticipated, precisely because of these shifts in global gas markets. And if the rise in oil prices makes the crisis in the Eurozone even more acute, then that has a really serious knock-on effect for Russia, because most of the foreign direct investment is not just coming from Sweden, it's coming from the rest of Europe, and this will really impinge on European companies. So getting back to that question that you'd asked, Rich, that we didn't address, this isn't a very promising picture. And as Cliff has pointed out, the position of the opposition and the middle class is also dependent on that boost in the Russian economy, which doesn't look like it's coming either. So, I mean, really, the picture, just like for the rest of us sitting here, is not that rosy for Russia, even though the economy is quite robust. There's all of these knock-on effects in the domestic politics.
Yeah, there is one other factor which is out there, which, and I'm not sure exactly how it plays into the calculations by the Russian government, but in Israel you have probably, a million plus Jews of Russian descent with the immigration wave that's taken place since 1990. That's got to have some impact, although I'm not quite sure how that plays. But presumably that group, that population, to the extent that Iran has the capability and then does retaliate against Israel, you know, that population is going to be at risk.
Well, that relationship has shifted really dramatically over the last several years. There's a much closer relationship now, as we all know, between Russia and Israel than there was before, which has given Israel more leverage inside of Russia, but also gives Russia now much more of a stake in Israel, a very different stake from the past in the Middle East. So I think on all fronts, this is going to be a very tricky set of developments for Moscow and Mr. Putin to handle. Get the gentleman here in the purple shirt.
Hi, Garrett Nott. I'm a graduate student at George Washington University. We've talked about sort of the internal business elite and the oligarchs. I'm just sort of wondering, what about the Russian diaspora, not only in Israel, but other first world nations, North America and Europe, this sort of business elite that's been living abroad for the last 10, 15 years? Is there any way to see any shifts in where they're throwing their money? Are any of them now interested in either supporting an NGO, transparency organizations, or getting it back into politics now that they're sort of seeing some winds of change? Is there a role for that sort of community with all that money to be played in Russia now that you might not have seen 6 months ago? Thanks.
Thanks. And then we had last question, the gentleman at the back of the aisle. Yes. Yes, sir. No, the microphone's right beside you.
Yeah. Yes, my name is Yaya Fanusi. I'm the lead person for the Special Operations Division, United States of Africa 2017 Project Task Force. But I'm not going to ask a question or comment dealing with that. I'm going to ask a question because I think Brookings have to do a modification when you're doing a presentation. You guys are expert in what you're doing, but there's certain question that came up like power elite, political class. But because you are not a PhD in political science or political economy, you do not understand. So it looks like there's a shortcoming. So I would suggest that when you're having things like that, you bring a panelist who is an expertise in those areas. So they could give a total picture, because the things that you're explaining, somebody who have a PhD in political science, somebody who studied Soviet politics and Eastern Europe, make like you're not competent. That's what I did, okay? So I'm watching you here.
Do you have a comment on the political elite? I think I'm a historian, so yes, guilty for not being a PhD.
All you need to say that is not your area of expertise. It's somebody in the audience who could do that. Thank you.
Well, the political elite question, actually, as most people sitting here will know, is actually a very complicated one in the Russian thing. It doesn't take a PhD in political science to know that. The political elite, the concept of political elite in Russia has actually changed dramatically over the last several years. And this is actually part of the reason why we're having, as a whole, why Mr. Putin himself is having a great difficulty in deciding what is happening into his country. Just recently down at CSIS, there was a very interesting gentleman named Mikhail Dmitriev who was here, and many of you might have gone to listen to him, who is a social scientist from Russia, and who actually said the elite in Russia is completely different now in the last 10 years than how it was before. So the problem is one of defining who you are talking about, which is why I asked Jeff the question to say, well, who does he have in mind? Because every single person is asking a different question about who the elite is, and they have something different in mind. Some people mean the Russian oligarchs. Some people actually mean the middle class. Some people mean the old Soviet nomenclature, which is what he said, which is why I pointed to Andrei Ilyaronov, who's left us now, but who used to be a presidential advisor. So in actual fact, that question of the elite is much more complicated, just to give ourselves some fairness. But we're not PhDs in political science, but we are PhDs in economics and in history. So, you know, we can't have everything, unfortunately, just like Mr. Putin can't have everything, sadly, even at Brookings. It's not possible. But we did bring Will Partlett, who's a constitutional scholar, and we didn't anticipate Andrei Ilyaronov's question.
I think that's a totally revolutionary idea, that somebody in a Washington think tank should limit themselves to things they actually know about.
We tried.
That's the whole point of being here.
You
know? You can talk about anything.
We know something. We don't know everything. And that's the whole issue that we're raising here today, that sadly, even if you are the president of Russia, you cannot be omniscient and have everything that you know, just as we cannot at Brookings either. But there was the question about the Russian diaspora and the business elite. I mean, again, this is getting back to the elite question, a question of who you mean. You know, the various oligarchs who have made themselves fixtures on the Forbes top fortune lists who have bought property in the United States, people like Yuri Milner, who are large investors in Facebook, and what role they play, or the kinds of people that I was talking about, the self-made entrepreneurs that on the smaller scale of people who have made businesses and have been predated upon in Russia or have moved over here. And actually what you've started to see in the opposition is this different class of the business elite, you know, people who might not be oligarchs, billionaires, but might in fact be millionaires, are actually starting to now play a role in politics. So the opposition is actually getting some of its funding explicitly from these smaller business people who feel predated on by the system, who are not happy about it and would like to see a change. They want to see the enforcement of the rules. So they're actually trying to support a number of the opposition candidates. And then, of course, we had Mr. Prokhorov explicitly jumping in to the political campaign, trying to take the helm of one of the political parties back in before the December parliamentary elections, running his own campaign as an individual candidate in the presidential election, getting 7% of the vote. And a lot of these business elites are now international. There are people who have... Israel is a classic case in point. There are a lot of Russian business elites who have businesses that are rooted in Israel, particularly in software and the high tech, who have connections back in Russia themselves. But you're also asking a question about the Russian diaspora. And there are now various estimates about how many people have left Russia over the last decade or so. And I mean, Cliff, maybe you might like to come on this, because it ties back to this question where we really started off about this new urban middle class. There are different figures for this. You'll hear this from different people. Some people will say more than 1 million Russians have emigrated during this period, and then others will say that more than 4 million have left. Clearly, that's a different number. So there are people who have emigrated and taken up other citizenship, and they may have also handed in their Russian citizenship. There are lots of people who are working overseas in Europe and here in the United States. The US government, for example, gives a figure of 40,000 Russians on working visas in Silicon Valley, for example, in Palo Alto. And there are similar sorts of figures in London and in Paris and in Berlin of people who are working there. And these are not really the people who are playing politics. The people who are out on the streets in the opposition are the same kinds of people who decided not to leave, who wanted to stay in Russia and wanted to see things change. And so far, there seems to be some evidence of some of the elites who've been living and working and studying elsewhere who are coming back and trying to see where this movement goes. But you have a lot of different categories of people that you're talking about. And Russia has a huge diaspora now on an international level. And it's very hard to get an exact figure. Contrary to the gentleman's request, no one has a good figure on this, not the World Bank, not any, even the Russian government itself, of how many people are actually physically permanently living overseas, because many people have returned their citizenship and their passports, but they're clearly not in Russia because they're actually living and working somewhere else. And this is going to be the challenge for the Russian government in the future, is how to bring back many of these people in the diaspora who are still nominally Russian citizens but have not been living in Russia for the past decade because they've chosen to be somewhere else.
In fact, there are 2 points, one which Cliff was is a lot smarter than me on, but one indicator might be what happens with capital outflow, which I think some of the numbers show quite a bit of capital moving out of Russia over the past year. What happens to that, and does that go up, does that go down? That may be one indicator of at least how the elite and the diaspora are thinking about Russia. The other is just kind of an anecdote. When Dmitry Medvedev was in Silicon Valley back in 2010, and he met a number of the Russian diaspora that were there doing high-tech projects in Silicon Valley. And what I heard was at one point he asked one of them, what would it take to get you to come back to Russia? And the response was nothing. There is nothing that you could do. I suspect that if Vladimir Putin had the chance to go to Silicon Valley and meet with that same group tomorrow and ask that same question, the answer would be exactly the same.
Cliff? Yep. PhD in economics? Well, we'll leave it at that. And anyway, we hope that the next time, we'll see you all again. We'll certainly see you around at some of the other things, and we'll try to do better next time in finding constitutional scholars and people who can represent everything. But anyway, thank you very much for coming and joining us today. Thanks.